God is allowing a lot of these things to happen so that we can build up these muscles of character. And then we have that freedom to act the way that we want to act instead of being enslaved by a certain passion or a certain pride. And this is what Mary had.
We are women encouraging and equipping women to universally and uniquely serve Christ in their feminine vocation.
By embracing joy, laughter, freedom, and friendship, we are seeking to thrive in the trenches of our domestic churches.
Welcome to Thriving in the Trenches podcast. This is Becky Carter.
And this is Megan Schreiber. You are listening to episode number 21, titled The Marian Option. This episode marks the commencement of our second season of Thriving in the Trenches podcast. And to kick things off, we have a dynamic guest today. We are very blessed to have author and blogger Carrie Gress. Carrie has a doctorate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America and is a faculty member at Pontifex University. Dr. Gress is a regular blogger at the National Catholic Register, has written for Alatea, Catholic Vote, Catholic World Report, The Federalist, and The Stream. She is a frequent guest on Ave Maria Radio, EWTN Radio, and Relevant Radio, and has appeared on BBC, CBC, and EWTN Television. She is the author of Nudging Conversions, a practical guide to bringing those you love back to the church, Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood, and co-author with George Weigel of City of Saints, A Pilgrim's Guide to John Paul II's Krakow. Her latest book, The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis, was released May 2017. And we are super excited to have Carrie join us. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to join you two today.
Thanks so much for being here, Carrie. I was hoping that you would introduce our listeners to you and just kind of a little bit about your family life and background.
Right. Well, I grew up in Oregon, and I grew up in a very secular environment, and at some point in college really decided that it was time to take my faith a little bit more seriously. And Thankfully, it really changed my life, and it's led me all over the world. I've lived in Poland and Italy and France and all over, but I'm currently living in just outside of Washington, D.C., and I'm married to a wonderful gentleman that I met in Italy, although he's American, and we have four children, and I'm homeschooling, so life is busy and full, but we feel really incredibly blessed.
That's awesome. Now, what are the ages of your children?
The oldest is 8 and the youngest is almost 3. So 8, 6, 4, and 2 at this point.
Busy.
That sounds fun. Busy and fun, right?
Yes, it is fun, but yeah, definitely very busy. But, you know, I've been really appreciating the time with this 2-year-old because previously I always had another baby when there was someone at 2. So it's been great to appreciate, you know, all these things that I've sort of missed because of hormones and fatigue and, you know, all of those things that are wrapped up in having a new baby. So, yeah, it's been great.
Yep. That is so great. Well, we were drawn to so much of your work. I think one of the things that jumped out at us is the Marian option, right? We've been hearing a lot in our Catholic world of a lot of these quote options, end quote, you know, the Benedict option. I even think I saw something on the Franciscan option. There's a lot of different things, but you've taken that in a different direction. So can you speak into the Marian option?
Sure. Well, it started because of the fact that I was intrigued by the Benedict option. I have a huge devotion to Saint Benedict. I used to live right near the palazzo where he prayed in Rome, and my husband was actually a Benedictine monk for 4 years before we met. And so I was really interested in the idea, and so I started digging into it, and of course Rod Dreher is the author of this. And as I was looking at it, I also remembered that John Paul II's life is, I mean, really all these options are answering the question, how is it that we deal with Christian persecution as well as the civilization that we find ourselves in now with all of this incredible drama and just decay happening around us? And so I looked at the life of John Paul II and realized that this is someone that you know, live through Christian persecution better than anybody. And what did he do? And so I was able to sort of piece together something of a field guide of his life that it's an article you can find on my website, and talked a little bit about, you know, all the different tactics he used to deal with Christian persecution, whether it was first the Nazis and then later, of course, with the Soviets. And what I noted was that there wasn't just one method that he used. He didn't just retreat. I mean, yes, he retreated at one point when he needed to avoid the Nazis because they were hunting him down. But then at other stages, he used politics. He used his gift of theater and speaking to influence people. I think he's credited with helping to bring down the Soviet Union without really a shot being fired. And that in and of itself is really miraculous. But behind all of that, of course, is really this devotion that he had to Our Lady. And so it's if we look at all these problems that we have today in the world, one of the things that just stuck in my head was, well, if we're worried about conversions, we're worried about heretics, we're worried about Islam, we're worried about all of these kinds of realities, Mary has dealt with them in spades over the centuries. And so it was kind of this small idea of thinking about, you know, the 10 million converts in Mexico when Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared and those kinds of instances. And I just started researching it. And it was like this thread, you know, it kept coming. The more I dug, the more I found. And all of these different interplays would happen between, you know, one apparition here and another apparition there. And it was just fascinating. And so that's really what the book is sort of a bird's eye view of all the things that Our Lady has done historically that we have, you know, good records of, and looking at it in a big picture, instead of just looking at one particular apparition or one particular theological point, I wanted to look at her in a big way and see her in very real terms and how it is that she's so, wants to be present to us in all of our difficulties and struggles. And that's really what she can do for us now. So that's really where the idea came from.
So beautiful. Like you, I was also drawn to the Benedict option, you know, wanting to mm-hmm. read more and understand a little bit more. And I sit in a place of, you know, a great spot. If you're considering diocese, you know, I've got Archbishop mm-hmm. Chaput as our shepherd, and we're blessed. We're really, really blessed. He also mm-hmm. has a great book out,
right.
Strangers in a Strange Land. Yes. And, you mm-hmm. know, the whole theme running through a lot of these, too, is that element of, you know, living in a post-Christian world. So right. What I love about what you're talking about in the Marian option and going back to John Paul's journey is, you know, the everyday Catholic, like who's listening mm-hmm. right now, is thinking, well, I'm not dealing with Nazis. I'm not dealing with the Soviets, right? I'm not. But right. but we are, in such a subtle way, mm-hmm. dealing with persecution. Now, mm-hmm. I'm sure mm-hmm. there's a listener saying, well, I don't know where you live, Megan, but I'm not really being persecuted. But mm-hmm. but it's almost like this silence persecution, mm-hmm. right? Is there this element mm-hmm. of placing ourselves in silence. And I mean, that they feel that perhaps they can't just gently say something to mm-hmm. somebody else mm-hmm. because they are living in a bit of fear that they're going to be labeled as too religious or they're going to be labeled in a specific way. And I think mm-hmm. there are people that don't even realize that they don't have the freedom to live out their faith as fully as they probably would like. So it's mm-hmm. like, it's almost so subtle.
Yeah, no, I think that's an incredible point. And I think the other reality is just looking at the fact of, are people happy? Because we know that when the faith is lived out well, that there's a real flourishing of the human person. This is what God wants. And this is something that I think as Catholics, we sort of forget and take for granted because we're experiencing the graces from all the sacraments and a lot of kinds of joy that most people don't experience on a daily basis because they don't have a sacramental life. And we kind of forget that, yes, the two go hand in hand, that there's a joy and a happiness and a flourishing that happens when we are living out our faith. And a lot of people don't have that. And so we're seeing in spades, you know, if you look at these markers of, I call them the sort of an index of happiness, it's very clear that people are struggling. And it is because of this kind of silent persecution, as you mentioned. But I think it's also because the culture is so full, it's created this void of joy and flourishing. And we're working against ourselves in so many respects instead of doing things that are actually going to fulfill us.
It's as if we've been fed from the table of non-suffering, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we've been fed so much that suffering is bad and to avoid it at all cost, and, you know, to avoid and anything that places us in an uncomfortable way. Mm-hmm. But the reality of being a Catholic is we're called to just the opposite of that. We're mm-hmm. called to endure suffering because mm-hmm. there is suffering in life. And we even call ourselves into the uncomfortable by certain things that we do in our faith, right?
Right.
You know, like maybe fasting during Lent. If somebody's really suffering and we're praying for them, sometimes we have to fast for them too. That's mm-hmm. hard. That's uncomfortable. So
all of those things, right? And I think that, but the complement to that, of course, is that people don't realize that in that suffering, there can also be incredible joy and peace and different graces that I think we don't talk about enough, and we don't point to how those difficulties can really change us and transform us and bring us joy and peace in a way that nothing else can.
That's right.
Well, it really brings us to a place of freedom. You know, like Megan said, we flee from suffering. Mm-hmm. I had a priest in confession tell me one time about, what was he talking about? That gluttony was like one of those root sins. Mm-hmm. That if you are feeding yourself mightily in the flesh, that it leads to other sins because you're not practicing self-control on a daily basis, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's been a long time since I've heard him say it and I've used it in daily life. But it makes sense, because if you're not aware that at some point we should be denying ourselves every whim that we have, mm-hmm. then you're going to forget to do that on a big basis, right. on a big level.
Well, I remember being asked on an airplane about a year ago. I met a gentleman who was a business executive, and he said, "Oh, do you have children?" I said, "Yes, I have four." And he said, "Is that fun?" And it was one of these things where I just didn't even know how to wrap my mind around the question. Like, what do you mean, is that fun? Like, I'm not having children because it's fun. Like, you know, that there were so many more things that, like, I just didn't even know where to start.
Right.
You know, that fun was sort of the last question. And yet I think that's what we come back to, is this idea. I mean, gluttony, certainly, but gluttony in terms of, is it fun? Are we entertained? Is this all of those kinds of ways that we're gluttonous that don't really relate to food necessarily, but are mm-hmm. more psychological. I think that's part of our problem too, is just there's a new set of categories that we are not really talking about.
Always seeking pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way to encapsulate all of them, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. So as women, and we hear the Marian option, do you have some pointers to live that out on a simple daily basis?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that's what it comes back to. I think if you look at the Benedict option, now Rod Dreher has sort of changed his position as he went deeper into the concept. But initially, the idea was sort of to retreat. And, a lot of that is just completely impractical for a lot of us who are tied to cities, we're tied to schools, we're tied to jobs. You know, there are different things that we're not just simply not going to be able to, you know, up and move our whole lives near some monastery in the hills of Italy or whatever. So that's what one of the things I love about the Marian option is that Our Lady really, it's very simple. It starts with a rosary, and this is something that she has asked for repeatedly throughout the centuries at different apparitions. And I only used about 9 apparitions. There are about 15 that are Vatican approved, and I didn't want to delve into any that hadn't been approved fully by the Vatican yet, because I know that it stirs up controversy, and I just didn't want to have to go back and change the book later. But the rosary is the most simple place. And certainly Marian consecration is another level of learning to create this relationship with Mary, really looking at her as our spiritual mother. And I think that was one of the things that came through the most in this book, in my own research, was just seeing how focused she is upon us as individuals, upon us as her children, and really diving into that reality. And I think that's something that we can sort of feel removed from. And yet, certainly the rosary can bring us closer to that. And you know, making small sacrifices, whether it's throughout the day or doing, fasting on Wednesdays or Fridays, you know, little things like that, are also things that we can do to live out the Marian option. But what it comes down to is that instead of saying, we all should be doing X. What the Marian option does is we should all be focusing on this relationship with Our Lady, and then she will tell us what it is that we're supposed to be doing. Then this is, again, the example of John Paul II's life. He had this nimbleness of spirit. He could do all of these different things, use all of these different ways to appeal to people because of the fact that she was guiding him and helping him. And, you know, that's really where his strength came from. On many levels. And so this is what she wants to do for each of us. So we may end up being called to do something dramatic and radical. And yet it'll feel natural because she's the one that's guiding us. And it's, again, that relationship is at the core of it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. No, I love that, that we're going to ask Mary what she wants us to do. Mm-hmm. There's no prescriptive way of doing it. And, you know, part of our mission is helping women universally and uniquely in their feminine vocation, because we're all called to something different, yet the same, all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you clarify that, that it's not, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. It's right. The relationship.
Right. And I think that's really at the heart of it. And that's one of the things that we lose sight of is it's our relationship with her, but then even looking at her relationship with the Trinity, I spent a whole chapter in the book talking about that, which is, I think I grew a lot in that chapter, just thinking about her relationship with the Holy Spirit in a way that I'd never thought about. But, you know, we hear and think superficially about her being the spouse of the Holy Spirit. But what does that mean in a very practical term when you've got, you know, the masterpiece of God's creation and you've got the Holy Spirit, you know, the two as a this marital bond, you know, to have them influencing your life is really overwhelming and dramatic to think about in practical terms.
Carrie, about a month ago, or actually it was a couple months ago, I was asked to speak and talk about Mary and in our feminine role, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. That's a huge, huge undertaking, but you know, right. Yeah, sitting in prayer, there was just a lot of simplicity that was kind of placed on my heart that I became very convicted with. And that was that Mary made herself available to Jesus, like literally available to him, right? Mm-hmm. She was receptive to Jesus, like literally physically receptive to, you know, carrying our Savior, right? Mm-hmm. And then also she was courageous for him, right? And so those kind of became the hallmarks for me as a woman thinking about, like, am I available? And that meant even in that morning prayer time, am I thinking about what I have to do today? Am I like go to the grocery store, or am I just sitting and making myself available to the Lord? And, you know, so there were just these little benchmarks, but we think about that too in our Marian consecration is we're so giving ourselves to Jesus through Mary, right? That it's like, that to me is, oh my gosh, there's like this, this heaviness almost gets lifted off of me. Like, wow, you know, I'm having a mother guide my steps, and every step she's bringing me closer to him, always closer to Jesus. And that's like awesome, right? You know, that's because now we're getting such heavenly support and heavenly guidance in that.
Right.
And so that's the piece that we like to talk about too on our podcast is that femininity. And as you're talking about these things, and I love those little simple ways and simple reminders. One of the things that I really enjoyed reading that you wrote, and I really encourage our listeners to go back to the National Catholic Register to, I believe it was January 27th. So, you know, we're going back a couple months, but you had an article talking, and the title of it is this: If There Is an Antichrist, What About an Anti-Mary? And when I was really reading through this one really struck me, because I thought, so many times I love being a woman. I've always loved being a girl. I love embracing my femininity. And I look at our culture and I'm thinking, when, where, and how did that get hijacked? So
right.
So like this
huge question.
Yeah, it's a huge question. So I don't know if we can kind of roll and talk a little bit about that topic too.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think you articulated it well in terms of that role of receptivity. I've started calling it dynamic receptivity because I think so often we hear the word receptivity and we think doormat. And that's sort of the knee-jerk reaction a lot of women have to thinking about receptivity because we've never really fleshed it out before. We've never thought about it in terms. We just have right. sort of heard what the culture tells us. And, you know, if it's either got to be one extreme or the other. And so clearly people who are promoting real femininity must be talking about being a doormat. And of course, that's not at all. So I think you articulated it well. But one of the things that I noticed when I was doing all this research on Our Lady was that whenever you're talking about Mary, there's always theologically this context that she's put in as the new Eve. And of course, you know, there's Adam and Eve, there's Christ and Mary, the new Adam, the new Eve. And then it struck me at one point that we talk a lot about there being an antichrist, and I don't necessarily mean it as a person of an antichrist. St. John talks about in one of his letters about there being a movement of an antichrist. So it can be a general movement of group of people instead of it just being an individual. But it struck me that no one's ever talked about an anti-Mary. Given that you always have this male-female, why is it we've never talked about that? And it's been a fun concept to dive into. I've had theologians and Mariologists contact me and say, this is fantastic. I can't believe you're writing. You know, where did this come from? So it's been fun to sort of stumble onto something new, especially because I'm not a theologian. I'm a philosopher. But what struck me most was just looking at our own culture. And it seems like we're living in this age of an anti-Mary because of the fact that we have this unprecedented reality where women are really the fabric of what it means to be a woman has really become threadbare. And, you know, it's really diminishing. So what's happened, of course, has affected our husbands, it's affected our children, it's affected the whole community in ways that I don't think that we even realize. And what it is this rejection of all things that are connected to the virtues of Mary and sort of moving away from that. And I think that's been a real struggle. But one of the things that I point out in the article is just, you know, this idea that women are equal to men, all of this stems from Christianity. This is sort of the real irony of it, is it starts with Christ. And then in the Middle Ages, you have this full flourishing of Marian devotion that gave women this kind of equality that didn't really exist ever before. In fact, I laugh about how, In Greek philosophy, Aristotle actually describes women as deformed males. And yet here we are in our own age and we're just doing everything we can to sort of become, you know, proving Aristotle right. Can we show ourselves to be deformed males rather than embracing who it is that God has created us to be and the unique role that we have in that particular mission as a woman. So anyway, yeah, it's been an interesting concept to really think about, but also helpful to see what's going on in our own culture and why it's been, why it's such a difficult thing to sort of swim upstream by not taking on all of these values that are being so heavily promoted by women in our culture today.
Yep. You know, in that article too, you'd reference Bishop Barron's article, The Trouble with the You Go Girl Culture. Mm-hmm. And you were just chatting about that too, because, you know, as a mother of, you know, four girls and two boys, I look at the heaviness that is somehow placed on the males of our culture as a result of that.
Right.
You know, that it's this level of confusion that's being mm-hmm. layered onto them, that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of makes my heart ache as a mom of boys. Right.
Right. Yeah, no, and I think that's a great point, because the fact that men have been so sidelined. I mean, they are almost given no voice when it comes to issues related to women. And I think all you have to do is look at any commercial today. And of course, it's a white male who's, you know, an idiot being portrayed in the commercial.
Right. That's right.
And I think men don't really know how to respond. I think this is just, they feel like they end up just putting their foot in their mouth and making things worse if they do respond in a certain way. So it's really incumbent upon women to recognize this problem and to start recognizing it. And instead of being so focused on what it means to be pro-woman, we need to recognize that being pro-woman also involves being pro-husband, pro-fathers, pro-sons, you know, mm-hmm. pro-baby, pro-fetus, all of these things that we can't live in this isolated box, because that's certainly not how anyone flourishes or becomes happy or even a civilization remains.
Exactly. If it's okay, I just want to read a quick line. You write, "The devil knows that all these marks of the anti-Mary, rage, indignation, vulgarity, and pride, short-circuit women's greatest gifts, wisdom, prudence, patience, unflappable peace, intuition, and the capacity for a deep relationship with God." Boom.
Right? Wow.
It's so true, because if you look at so much of where the culture is, and you know, I have girls in college, so it seems like that pivotal point where you're seeing all this. It is that you go girl and you flaunt and the level of vulgarity, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how did we get to this? You know, and it's interesting. I have a daughter who's going to school in the South, and one of the things that we noticed is that, you know, Southerners really value politeness. It's just an almost at least inherent in with the people that we were around, and you know, we're from the Northeast. They don't really value politeness all the time, right? I mean, you know, you can just see the cultural differences in that, and so it led us into a conversation about what is it to be a polite female too, in that, and it led us down that path of speaking of virtues, because they're not seeing it in movies, they're not seeing it in magazines.
Well, and I think it comes back to also this dynamic between men and women. I think one of the things that we've done is really alienate ourselves from what it is that men are looking for. I mean, there's so many women that want to be married, would love to be married, and yet all the virtues that we're promoting are not the kinds of virtues that are necessarily going to make great marriages. And that was one of the fun things to research is just sort of looking at what men say when they don't know women are listening, which of course we can find in great poetry and in music lyrics. There's this constant thread of what kind of woman that men are looking for, and it's not what feminist values are. It's something much more focused on, you know, that list you just read, as well as politeness and, you know, not being brash, not being sarcastic. All of these kinds of things just tear at the fabric of relationships in a way that you know, just put stress on them makes it very difficult for them to flourish. And I think part of this is why people are so incredibly unhappy. And so even looking at getting back to that question of, is this serving women well? Are these kinds of anti-Mary values helping women? And of course, the answer, if you look at anything related to statistics on women, makes it very clear that they're not flourishing. And yet, in the church, sadly, we've kind of gotten away from even this understanding that there's a whole role for women. I think because of the fact that we've been sort of in triage mode for so long, we've really missed some of the gifts that women have spiritually. And I mean this for every woman, not just for mothers, not for religious, you know, that there's a very specific call that every woman has. And I noticed, and I talk about this in my book, Ultimate Makeover, that if we look at a lot of the women religious throughout the centuries, and the pattern that happens where they get an idea for something wonderful, whether it's, you know, different devotions or whatnot, it always starts out as a very small idea that God gives them in prayer. He whispers something to them very quietly, and they only know about it. And then eventually it grows and it gets bigger. You know, St. Faustina is a perfect example of this. And then it takes on a life all of its own. Well, it mimics exactly what happens in pregnancy, where we've got this small thing, that small person inside of us that only we know about. And then eventually this person grows and becomes something much more beyond, you know, our own imagining and this whole life outside of us. So to see, I think these kinds of dynamics that women have the capacity to develop when we have this deep relationship with the Trinity, it's very exciting. And this is really where I think our hope and joy can start being refocused again, instead of looking for it in very superficial ways outside of ourselves.
Yeah. Well, my mind is just reeling with about 5 million things. Talking about the virtues and the line that Megan read from your article, which I haven't read that one, so I'm definitely going to have to go back and absorb it. But a lot of this conversation reminds me of our interview with Gloria Purvis, and it's something that just hit me that I never recognized or realized before, and I'm guessing I'm probably not the only one in the world with this issue, but she says, when did equality become women being men? When did being a man become what equality is?
Right.
So pointing out the virtue of the woman, I mean, for me, I'm Italian and Catholic, or I am a Catholic, but I'm Italian and Irish, and I'm from Louisiana. I have a little bit of fire to me. And so the truth is that I have to learn and work on self-control to be more gentle, to be more humble, to be less sarcastic. And so that's where my true strength is when I can practice those virtues.
And that is the, I mean, you just described what meekness is. I think this is one of the things that has completely lost. We hear the word meek and we just think of some clammy woman in the corner. But in fact, meekness is actually the sign that you have all these great strengths and yet you can rein them in. It's used, I think, historically with regard to horses, bridling them and having their strengths channeled to something greater than what it would be if they were just a mess. You know, they didn't have any self-control. And I think this is where women have really, this great disservice happens, because all of these things that are in fact virtues are now denigrated to look like vices and vice versa. So we have this sense of, you know, be true to yourself and whatever comes to mind is okay to say and all of these kinds of things. Well, in fact, we know that that can be quite damaging to all kinds of relationships, and that we can go a lot farther if we can harness those things and say what we want to say when we want to say it, instead of feeling like we're just totally out of control all the time. So I think that's an incredible point, because we are encouraged so much to this being brash or vicious or sarcastic or what have you, when in fact that's not a sign that, you know, we're really in control of ourselves. It's just a sign that we're flowing with the rest of the culture.
Right. Well, you mentioned about women wanting to be married, and my husband actually points this out, and he notices it way more than I do. If you're, certain women who are very strong, and he points it out. He says, you know, it's going to be hard for her. Men are going to be intimidated by her. That's how he describes it.
Right.
Because they're so vocal, they're so strong, and and when I say strong, I don't mean that we shouldn't be strong, because like you just said, practicing the virtue is really what shows our strength. But they have this persona that is so big and so out there, and it's not practicing that meekness. And I wonder if that leads to in marriage. Well, I don't have to wonder, because I am the living embodiment of it. But when you're so strong or outwardly vocally saying everything that comes across your mind, it can make marriage very difficult.
Yeah. Well, and this is, I mean, you're describing the story of my life. I spent years wanting to be married. And I think at one point, right when I was around 30, I had this series of boyfriends that they all broke up with me. And then they went on to marry a school teacher. And, you know, at this point I was working in Washington, D.C. I was working on K Street. I was doing my PhD in philosophy. I was doing all the things that women told me would make me happy insofar as being ambitious and doing, you know, living in interesting places, doing interesting things. And then I was miserable. And so I finally, you know, four boyfriends later was like, okay, what is it that the school teachers have that I don't have? And started looking at this really critically. And this is when I started paying attention to what is it that men say when they don't know women are listening. And I was fascinated to hear them use words like sweet. I mean, this was a totally new concept to me. Like, really? Sweet is important? And it was very astounding. And I was living my faith at this point. I'd been a Catholic, you know, really rooted in the sacraments for a long time. But there was no voice that ever said or suggested to me that maybe I needed to sort of tone it back a little bit, and that being so ambitious and outspoken wasn't serving me well, wasn't serving anyone well. And so that was really when I started looking at these issues and seeing, you know, that maybe behavior modification could help significantly in my own case. And actually, there was a triumphant moment when it was a hot summer day, and I was in the metro in Washington, D.C., and some man came up to me and said, "Are you a school teacher?" And it was great. I mean, it was like, wow, I can act the part. I mean, it was great. It was sort of one of those fake it till you make it, and really, transform my life a lot. But I've seen how, what a grace that was to go through that and during that stage of my life to understand, how it relates to raising children and how it relates to that idea of being dynamically receptive and what it is that people need. I think we have this impression that men are attracted to this kind of brashness instead of sort of repelled by it, because that's what we've been told. So sort of reworking the hard wiring that we've been given is something that I, is important to just even consider. This could help us. This could help our daily lives. This could help our children. This could help our families. This could help our goals.
Carrie, one of the things that you talked about is, that encouragement that women, speak their minds at all time and it's all good. Could you imagine if the male world was like that, right? I mean, boy, they'd hear from our side pretty quickly,
right?
And right. I think back to on an earlier podcast, Becky, that we did where we had Elizabeth, my college daughter, on, and Samantha Povlock. My daughter was talking about, when did equality be the thing that everybody was striving for, as opposed to celebrating the differences, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I
mm-hmm.
thought, it's true. And I was so thankful that, at 20, she could see the beauty and the value in differences. I'm thinking back even personally over to, say, my working career. I very, very rarely ever felt oppressed by a man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely at times felt oppressed by a woman, which is interesting. And mm-hmm. take it out of the corporate world and just kind of into daily living, I'll repeat that same phrase. I haven't. I mean, any oppression mm-hmm. that I felt was inflicted upon me by my own. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And there's a fantastic book. I recommend it to everyone. Everyone should read this book called Warriors and Worriers. And it's this woman, Oxford University Press published it. And I don't think they know what's inside of it because it's so politically incorrect that it's just amazing. It made it through the editorial process. But this woman went to all these different cultures around the world and looked at, Africa and all these kinds of places and drew out all these different patterns between men and women. And this is one of the things that she talks about is why it is that women have such a hard time with each other. Why the statistics show that more people prefer a male boss to a female boss. All of these kinds of things are really wrapped up in who it is that we are and connected in very deep ways to having children and this long-term reality that we need to take care of these children. We have to have resources at our fingertips. And so if that gets threatened, then, watch out. It was a fascinating thing to look at this and sort of see patterns in my own life or the things that I've done or other people have done to me and really understand it. But then even comparing that to the way that men think about things, the warrior side, it was just fascinating to really see why there's so many struggles both in the workplace, but then also just among women and men socially.
I really appreciate that it is your voice that is saying these things that sound they're very feminine. They're very sometimes countercultural, especially people who are fighting for this. I mean, the word feminism mm-hmm. is such a scary word, and people are fighting for the rights to it, and mm-hmm. I think it's good. And definitely being part of this podcast and talking to strong women who are in the workforce also, but that also claim themselves to be Catholic feminist. But they are firmly rooted in the teachings of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would add you to that list of women that we are talking to that are strong Catholic women. And they are in the workforce. I mean, you are definitely making an impact in through your books and your writing, and but you're also a mom, mm-hmm. and yeah. you see that role and the importance of the role and the meekness, and it's just, I really appreciate your witness in that. Oh, and I'm you. Glad that you're living it. You're backing up what you're saying.
That's
well,
right.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I think one of the reasons, one of the only reasons why I can do it so well is, or as effectively as I've been able to, is largely because I know my husband loves me, my children love me, and no matter what I published, even if I stop writing or publishing anything tomorrow, that reality is still so intact and so important to who I am as a person, that they're going to love me no matter what I write and whatever mistakes I make. And so I think that's one of the things that as women we completely overlook, just the freedom that affords us when we know that we're loved.
Carrie, I'm going to venture to guess that you're a really sweet wife too.
I try
and
very
a school
hard.
Teacher.
Wait yes. a minute. Exactly. No, but you know,
I have a great husband.
Yeah. That's
yeah,
great.
But that you are actually a school teacher now too. Have you thought about that?
It is fairly ironic, exactly. All of this, yes, has sort of come full circle, and now I'm a school teacher. So, no, it's great.
That's great.
God, it has a sense of humor, that's for sure.
He does. Absolutely. Okay, so you've spoken about the Marian option and this model of Mary. How can we connect that to our daily life in our modern world?
Right. I think that's the big question. I think that there's such a vast divide between who Mary is and who we understand women to be now that, it's even hard to talk about because it's almost laughable. Like, oh, women are supposed to be like Mary. Well, what does that mean? It's just such a wide divide mentally for us. But I spent a lot of time looking at this idea of the virtues. Now, I didn't realize until maybe about 10 years ago, how much the virtues played a role in people understanding flourishing and being happy. And that even the Greeks describe happiness as someone living out their virtues. And that means you're in control of your capacities. You're patient when you want to be patient. You have courage when you want to be courageous. All of these kinds of they're like muscles of the soul is kind of what I would describe them as. And we all, one of the things that's most fascinating is that we all have sort of one vice that we're all struggle with. And this vice actually is what we have the potential to have the greatest virtue in. And God tempts us against that virtue so that we can grow in it. Sort of like a bodybuilder, if they've got a weak spot, they're going to work on that muscle even more so. And that's why we have this one vice that we struggle with. So I think part of it is to sort of even understand the interplay of the virtues and the vices and recognizing throughout the day that God is allowing a lot of these things to happen so that we can build up these muscles of character. And then we have the freedom to act the way that we want to act instead of being enslaved by a certain passion or a certain pride or what have you. And this is what Mary had, was she was, full of grace, but full of these virtues. So she has the ability to have her will perfectly aligned with God's because her virtues are full. So I think that's one of the things that I talk about a great deal in Ultimate Makeover, and just describe these different virtues and how it is that even motherhood, and I would say spiritual motherhood, and just as much as biological motherhood or adopting children, it gives us in spades, because when you're in that environment as a mother, there are few things that you can sort of hold back for yourself anymore and still be an effective mother. So this is one of the reasons why I think it's such an important element to really see what it is that we get from motherhood, not just what we're giving. Because that's where, we think about these women in our culture, even historically, there's this great understanding of the wise old woman that, I think the movie Moana recently, you've got the woman who calls her, the grandmother calls her the village crazy woman. But she was full of wisdom. And we've kind of lost that in our culture today, where there are women that are full of wisdom when they get to that point when they're, the 70s and 80s, because of the fact that we've said that motherhood's not important anymore. You sort of finish your job and then you go back, you finish your job as a mom and you go back to work and you forget all those things that really make women beautiful and have this kind of wisdom that I think younger generations need. So all of that is sort of a long answer to say that we can get to it through the virtues, but probably a more short answer is even to be to help connect our culture with what it is that Mary was, is to just even look at her life, look at the different ways that she's influenced culture, whether it's apparitions, whether it's artwork. We have all of these different things. I mean, she's the most powerful. National Geographic has called her the most powerful woman in the world. And so I think we've got a lot at our fingertips to really think about and meditate upon and particularize to our own life and make it very individual. And that's, I think, the best thing too, is that she wants to help us with this. She wants to show us our gifts. She, you know, the relationship isn't just about learning about her, but she's going to show us who we are and how God sees us and what God, what his mission is for us in our own lives.
That's great. I'm glad you mentioned on the National Geographic cover story, wasn't it? It was a cover story. I can't remember when that was, that stated that. And I thought, that's right. That's right. And use the word most powerful.
Yeah.
Why didn't the feminist movement like glom onto that?
Right. Well,
yeah, right. Exactly.
It's back to the anti-Mary.
Exactly.
It's everything, and it comes down to the anti-Mary really is focused on this idea of being exactly like men and sterilizing ourselves and whatever it takes. So that's why, power can mean different things, but it's got to be apparently the right kind of power.
Right. Exactly. Well, I'm so glad you brought up the book, Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood. And you do talk about spiritual motherhood as well as physical motherhood, adoptive motherhood, which is great. And I think our listeners can find that through Dynamic Catholic. Is that correct?
Yep, it's there. It's also on Amazon as well. So, yeah.
Great. We'll load up our page with show notes of all your prolific writings and links, and we might not be able to put everything in there, but we'll redirect. How about that? We'll redirect Becky to Dr. Gress's website. So, this has been a blessing having you on. I encourage all of our listeners to, like me, soak in what Carrie has talked about and all of these beautiful ways in which we can model for the culture these Marian virtues. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right, Becky, how are you feeling after that amazing conversation with Dr. Gress?
Well, I'm a little lost for words because there are so many words. You know, just she is so full of wisdom and evidence and exhortation, and she is fantastic.
She is. And you know what's funny is, you know, the word meek is going to come up a lot when you and I are doing our wrap-up of this. She embodies that for me, listening to her. She is brilliant, and yet at the same time never makes me feel significantly less than brilliant when I'm having a conversation with her, right? There's no presumptuous air about her at all. And that's what I think about too in meekness isn't being weak in any way. It's a confidence, but it's a kind confidence. It's a courteousness. It's those things. So it's interesting that she kind of uses that word, because as the course of our interview went on, I thought, wow, she really embodies so much of the characteristics that I would think of when we talk about the Marian option.
Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, if you look at her bio and all of her accomplishments, I mean, she could totally be the opposite of meek. But I agree. I would not know that she was such an accomplished author, speaker, and everything she's done. Mm-hmm. I would not know that by just having conversation with her, honestly. And when don't you have the etymology of the word meek? Let's talk about that, because
I think that's really interesting. Because even your natural reaction there was to say, "Well, I would almost think she would be the opposite of meek," right? It's almost like, you know, we use words in our vocabulary so often that don't really mean what they mean, like the word nice. right? We could talk about that one in a minute. But previously I would think, oh, meek, does that mean like weak? Just like she described in the podcast, like it doesn't mean being a doormat, right? So here's the etymology of the word meek, going back, into the 1200s, essentially. So it meant really the following: gentle, quiet, unaggressive, benevolent, kind, courteous, humble, unassuming. I think they're all good things. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, sure, they're good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, it just, that's hard. It is hard to be gentle and kind, unassuming. That's the one that really is poking me. Mm-hmm. I'll have to ask the Lord why he's poking me about that. But
well, so I just read off a bunch of, you know, other ways to describe, other adjectives to mean meek. I didn't pull the actual, you know, Latin derivation of that. I think it is courteous, but I would want to be described by all of those words, right?
Sure.
Because the opposite of those words would be rough, loud, aggressive, evil, mean, rude, arrogant, presumptuous.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Right?
Fair enough. Who wants to hang out with somebody like that?
I know, right? Not me.
And that, well, and it doesn't, and it's not shining the light of Christ when you're living like that, nor do you feel truly free to be when you're in that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody feels good about themselves or about life when they are walking in that presumptuous, rude, mean way. I mean, they're grumpy and not happy.
Right. Exactly. It's certainly not something I'd strive for, any of those things.
Well, sure.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Exactly. So I am now really embracing this desire for meekness.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Carrie.
Yes, thank you. Because it's actually coming up. Yeah, that word meek is big, and the Lord is working in my own heart with it. So I think that's very cool. Thanks, Carrie.
Yeah. So with that, can roll into what our Bible passage is for the week.
Yeah. So in the Psalms, you know, David in his beautiful words, he's praying for guidance and praying for deliverance. And so we're going to go down to Psalms 25. We'll start at 8 and we'll end on 10, but we're going to highlight verse 9. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. Mm-hmm. So we're going to focus in on that. He leads the humble, which we've already learned is another word. It's part of what encapsulates meekness. In some translations of the Bible, actually use the word meek here. Mm-hmm. So he leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way.
Hmm.
I mean, so much of what we talk about in our podcast is freedom, true, authentic freedom to be who God created us to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is another scripture that is going to lead that. We have to be of what the Lord wants us to be. That's where true freedom is. That's where true joy is. That's where true happiness is, being who God created us to be.
That's right.
That's great. We're going to have to be humble to get there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, when we were talking about this in preparation, you sent me an awesome quote from St. Francis de Sales, who happens to be one of my favorite saints. I had not read this quote before, so this became our saint quote of this week. And St. Francis de Sales said, "Let us strive to be kind, meek, and humble with everyone, but especially so with those whom God has destined to be our companions. Let us not be one of those who are angels in public and devils at home." Mm-hmm.
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 Right. Hey, a little background on St. Francis de Sales actually is he struggled with anger.
Did not know
big
that.
Big time. Yes. He struggled with anger. So know that this is not just some docile saint. And he was fighting the heresies right after the Reformation, or as some want to call it, the revolt. And so he was in Germany with all those who had fallen away from the Catholic faith. They were following John Calvin, because, you know, after Martin Luther came, you know, John Calvin was the next biggest revolter. Right. And anyway, so he was having to go against this huge task. And but he did. He brought people back. And, you know, he did not do that through anger.
Right.
He did that through patience, kindness, meekness. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
that's great. Well, he was the perfect saint. That's a wonderful quote for us, which also brings us to a call to action for the week.
Let's do it.
Yes. So I'm hoping that this week we can readjust our mindset around that word meek, and we can think of that in the description of being benevolent, kind, humble, and unassuming. And like St. Francis de Sales says, let's start with our closest companions.
That's wonderful. Yes. Thank you so much, Megan. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us this week. We're so grateful for all of you with us in the trenches. You can find show notes on thrivinginthetrenches.com. Please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where you can join the conversation. Thanks for coming.